Jacksonville's Task Force on Civil Rights History is approaching its final deadline. Or is it? Some task force members want to continue working, but the incoming council president isn't yet convinced they have to. Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Ryan Bank in for Melissa Ross. We're always live here at 9, and make sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or through the WJCT app. And just ahead, civil rights era organizer and historian Rodney Hurst and current Jacksonville City Council President Anna Lopez Broche on the future of the Task Force on Civil Rights History. What do you think? Should the task force continue? Should it be made a permanent committee at City Hall? Or does it need to finish up its work? Give us a call at 549-2937. Then later, the Five and Dime Theater brings the wrenching story of Matthew Shepard to the local stage. We'll talk about the Laramie Project 18 years after it first premiered, plus sports with Cole Pepper and Yoga for Change. All of that ahead, but first this hour. In mid-February this year, City Council President Anna Lopez Broche, using the power vested in her as the legislative body's leader, created a 27-member task force to investigate why Florida, and by extension Jacksonville, was not included on the National Civil Rights Trail. Broche said she was inspired to do so after reading in late January a Florida Times Union editorial lamenting the city's exclusion. Broche, the first Filipina council president in Jacksonville history, staffed the body with artists, marketers, historians, and civil rights organizers. The task force's charge quickly broadened when it was discovered that to join the National Trail, the city and the state would have to pay an entrance fee to a consortium of tourism agencies. Jacksonville would also have to submit applications for its sites to be considered by out-of-state historians. So, instead of focusing on becoming part of that trail, the task force turned its attention to creating a local one, including but not limited to a comprehensive online timeline of Jacksonville Black history starting in the early 1800s, possible new markers and memorials, a possible new museum of civil rights history, a smartphone app, and more. If the task force is not extended by incoming Council President Aaron Bowman, it will have to conclude its far-reaching work by the end of Broche's council presidency, June 30th. A report of their findings is also due then. But the task force is asking for more time. Some members say the city would do well to even make the committee permanent. Still, Bowman says he's unconvinced, concerned that the task force, though important, he points out, is a drain on city resources. 27 members is just too large of a group to make concise decisions with, and if he were to extend its tenure, he's asking it narrows its focus. Joining me to talk about the future of the task force is Anna Lopez Broche, councilwoman at large and city council president. Welcome.
Good morning, Ryan.
And co-chair for the Task Force's Historical Timeline Subcommittee, Rodney Hurst. Hurst was a 1960 lunch counter sit-ins organizer and the author of It Was Never About a Hot Dog and a Coke, a personal account of the 1960 sit-in demonstrations in Jacksonville, Florida, and Axe Handle Saturday. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Ryan.
So, Mr. Hurst, we'll begin with you. Of course, the only one, to my knowledge, in this studio right now that has lived this history in Jacksonville. As concisely as you can, would you mind describing me your experience with Jacksonville's racial history?
Well, coming out of the days of segregation and the fact that you lived with signs that identified your place, when we started the sit-in demonstrations in 1960, resulting from joining the Youth Council NAACP and with local school teacher Rutledge Pearson as our advisor. It was insulting for blacks to go in stores in downtown Jacksonville to shop throughout the store as the store owners wanted you to do, but then not being able to go to a part of that store to sit down. We felt that was against human dignity and respect, and thus we started the sit-in demonstrations. Sit-in demonstrations were respectful, and they were nonviolent. The whole concept of civil rights, and unfortunately where you have to fight for rights as opposed to being included based on what the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence says, purely means that Black folk, based on the color of their skin, have been excluded and insulted, and they have been shunted to a place that they are supposed to know in American society. A civil rights task force that puts a narrative in the place is not instead of, it's in addition to. So as we chronicle some of the things that have happened in Jacksonville that have been purposefully excluded and neglected and ignored, we're just putting in proper perspective some of the things that have happened in Jacksonville with its very rich civil rights history.
Give us a call, 549-2937. What are your questions about the Task Force on Civil Rights History? What are your thoughts? Would you like to see its work continue? Perhaps it be made a permanent fixture at City Hall? Give us a call again, 549-2937. Now, Mr. Hirsch, you've been vocal, obviously, much of your life about the importance of remembering, and not just remembering, but recounting history, no matter how painful. You have another book called Unless We Tell It, It Never Gets Told. How well or how bad has Jacksonville done in telling the city's story as it relates to race and the civil rights movement, in your opinion?
Not well at all. One of the things that I have tremendous respect for with President Brochet is that she appointed this task force so that we could communicate and talk. Didn't mean that she was an advocate. I wouldn't expect anyone to be an advocate for civil rights history or Black history as I am. I never expect white folk to be able to say and do the same things that I do. All I ask is that we are fair and we listen to each other. And we have not done that in Jacksonville. So in a city like Jacksonville with Native sons like James Weldon Johnson and A. Philip Randolph and Bob Hayes and Jacksonville's connection with Mary McLeod Bethune and with President Emerita of both Bethune and Spelman, Dr. Johnetta Cole, and with a great church with revered and stated history like Bethel Church, Bethel Baptist Institutional Church, we don't know about that. We don't teach that kind of history in our schools. We don't teach that kind of history in community meetings. And from generation to generation, young people are further away from what actually happened. And history is painful. Civil rights history is painful. Black history is painful. But at the same time, it is noteworthy, and it should be taught. To exclude it only creates more problems. So when you talk about a civil rights task force, you're talking about communicating and setting the record straight.
Council President, I want to move to you. Tell me a little bit about your thought process of creating this task force. It obviously is a large task force, 27 members. And there are people on this task force like Rodney, like Alton Yates, that have lived this history. And there are people who work in telling histories. But what about reading that op-ed really moved you to take that kind of action?
Well, it was a function of conversations within the community about how unacceptable it is for Florida and Jacksonville to not be on the U.S. civil rights trail. And really, we didn't know why at the time. And so amongst those conversations, and then continued to grow, and then, you know, talk with this person, and everyone clearly, through the interest that has been expressed, and so many others who stepped up and said, I'd like to be a part of that too, but it had already been created. There's a lot of energy and excitement around making sure that we come together on this topic and do a better job of making sure that we tell our history, educate the community, and lift this up. Other communities throughout the U.S. are really making a name, making a mark for their communities from a tourism perspective, and sharing that history. And a lot of, you know, Mr. Hurst can share that people come here now without any, without much direction or marketing about the fact what our history is in the community. And so we could do a much better job of making sure people understand the importance role that Jacksonville has played in the civil rights movement.
And we're starting to get some calls. We'll get to those in just a moment. Again, the number is 549-2937. Council President, what was your first experience with this civil rights history? I mean, was this something that you remember being taught well when you were in school? Was this something that you took an interest in at a younger age? Or was it something that you felt like wasn't explained as thoroughly as it should have been?
So I can't speak to it being taught in school appropriately or remembering it from then. I would say my first meaningful connection to Jacksonville's history and civil rights was through Leadership Jacksonville. Mm-hmm. And the work that Leadership Jacksonville does to make sure that we understand the history of Jacksonville in a very meaningful way.
All right, we're going to go to your calls now. Yolanda is in Springfield. Yolanda, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having this show. And I just really have want to show my support for the committee. And I am a Black American. I'm a transplant from South Florida. And as I was planning to move to Jacksonville, I came directly to Jacksonville searching for Black history, and I couldn't find it. It's been shattered in pieces. It's under stones. And I've discovered a lot of it through, you know, connections through other individuals who've been here for a while. And I think it's pretty sad that, you know, it's not really being used, as Ms. Boucher says, to even from a standpoint from that perspective, because people, we do want to know. And so I think that the committee should continue. I don't think it should be diminished, and it's long overdue.
Thank you, Yolanda. So, Mr. Hurst, what do you think of Yolanda's thoughts on this? She moved to Jacksonville not knowing anything, she says, about the history of Jacksonville, and kind of surprised to find out how deep it actually is here.
I get calls often from groups coming to Jacksonville, Black groups, other groups who want to know something about Jacksonville's Black history. I meet them many times over at the Ritz Theater and Theater Museum. And I walk them through the history from Bethel Baptist Church being Bethel Baptist Institutional Church being founded in 1838 to James Weldon Johnson writing Lift Every Voice and saying a lot of people in Jacksonville don't know that as majestic a hymn as Lift Every Voice and Sing is, that it was written in Jacksonville.
A song that's known nationally and internationally as well, but isn't connected to Jacksonville in the national consciousness.
It's not. You know, James Weldon Johnson, the first Black lawyer, A. Philip Randolph with his storied history, dealing both with the Fair Employment Practices Commission, but the integration of the military and the 1963 March on Washington. These are great Americans whose hue of skin happened to be Black, but because it was Black and because they had to fight for the rights that should have been guaranteed to them, their heads and shoulders in the history of this country, yet Jacksonville does not even recognize them as they should as Native sons. Interestingly, in the Florida Civil Rights Hall of Fame, up until this year, of the 18 persons inducted, 6 are from Jacksonville, including James Weldon Johnson and A. Philip Randolph and Rutledge Pearson and Earl Johnson. They were signal fighters in the civil rights movement, and that's a history that we cannot ignore. History does not, we try to revise history, we try to romanticize history, unfortunately. But history is what it is. And all you do is you put the narrative in chronological order, and you include as opposed to exclude. When I went to Mr. Pearson's class in eighth grade as my eighth grade American history teacher, he would not teach us American history from the approved textbook for Negro students at that time in 1955. He told us to leave those textbooks home. Those textbooks only included the names of two black Americans, George Washington Carver and Booker T. Washington. And how unfortunate it is when I could not pick up a book and read about the contributions of my ancestors, yet white Americans and Europeans could read about the contributions that they made. And many times that was incorrect, and the narrative was inaccurate and dishonest. So when we talk about a civil rights task force, when we talk about putting together the chronology, we're not talking about making up anything. We're talking about codifying and memorializing what actually happened.
And we're going to go to some more calls. Matthew is by the airport. Matthew, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning. First of all, I want to say thank you to everyone for the great work that's been done with this. I really hope that we can, A, establish our own trail locally, and B, that we can join the national trail at some point. And the reason I say that is that being a black American here from Jacksonville, native son, I've lived all over the country. And when you see things such as Beyonce singing Lift Every Voice at Coachella and everybody freaking out on YouTube, that should be a sense of city and civic pride for us Jacksonvillians that was written right here in Jacksonville. And more of our students, black and white and brown, all should know that is a part of their culture, part of their history here. And it's a sad commentary that people have to explain from external to this city that was written here, as opposed to us being able to share and celebrate that. That should have been a news event with every news channel celebrating that this was sung and on a national stage. People were going crazy, but this is something that each person here can take pride in. So I wanted to comment on that, and also wanted to comment on the fact that you already have, as was mentioned, a museum, the Rich Museum, which actually has a very rich black culture narrative that goes on in the museum, and itself is a national monument to the black contribution to the Chitlin Circuit and such. Has there been any thoughts from an economic standpoint to expansion of the Rich Theater as that beacon, and starting that as a starting point for the trail, since it already exists, it already has exhibits? There's a vacant lot across the street that could be used to expand on. It's just something that I was thinking of as I was visiting the Ritz recently.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you for that call, Matthew. I'll go to the council president first and then over to you, Mr. Hurst. Talking broadly speaking about the financial issues around here, or the economic issues about establishing some of these new memorials and markers and actual trail. I know that they've also discussed, the task force has also discussed the possibility of a smartphone app and the creation of a civil rights museum in what is now that vacant church downtown that held some of these meetings after Axe Handle Saturday, that has itself a historical significance. But there's a price tag on all of those, and a lot of these things would require federal grants, or they would require annual applications for some of these funds to make this possible. As a city council president, but also in your job as a CPA, I mean, how do you see the financial calculus here to creating some of these things in Jacksonville?
Well, Ryan, that is a big really, that's the big question for everything, and which is why we have an inventory subcommittee, we have a marketing subcommittee, we have a finance subcommittee, because after we understand what we have and we think about how we want to market it, we have to understand how we want to pay for this or how we can pay for this. So we have a group that's exploring a lot of different avenues, and ultimately it is going to take money. It is important. And so we've got to start somewhere. And I think that the committee is being very thoughtful in terms of how is it that you take small steps to make sure that we're making some progress to put forth a plan that we can actually put some money to.
Now, jumping off of that, though, your successor says he's supportive of the task force's work, but that he thinks that 27 members is just too many. He'd also like to see the scope of the committee narrow. He is supportive of a museum. Why did you think it was so important to have as many members as 27 and to have all of these subcommittees? And is there something to that point that it's possible that the expansion of the charge here could use a little bit more of a focus?
So we, after this discussion that we've had so far and recognizing that there's so much ground to cover, that there's not been a focus on this as a community, the reality is that there are a lot of people who've been involved in this work in some way, in their contributions or are touching the work or have an interest in the work. And so I wanted to make sure that we had a very diverse group of people who could contribute to a lot of the different aspects of what we're trying to accomplish with this Civil Rights History Task Force. And there's been it's been really great to have a lot of these voices at the table because people are speaking up and have some really great ideas. And to the prior caller's point, there has been discussion about the Ritz Theater and its expansion and using that as a starting point. And the group's going to make their recommendations in a report. And so as far as continuing, I'm going to, you know, listen to the task force myself at our upcoming meetings in terms of the work that needs to be done going forward. There are challenges with this large group of people who often collaborate with one another. And Tony Allegretti made this comment on Twitter that they really aren't allowed to interact outside of the task force now, which is challenging for them because they do, as a matter of practice, work together to make sure that we're advancing civil rights history. So there are a lot of, I'll defer to listening to the committee and what we think we need to do moving forward, helping make that case to Council President-elect Bowman in terms of how to move forward. But there does need to be, in some capacity, at some interval, a continued focus on this work.
And Ryan, the other thing is that if I want to criticize something or pick a reason for not doing something, then I can find anything to do it. I can say we don't need to have 19 members of the city council. That's too many. So 27 members of a task force is not too many. This is a working group. This is not a talking group. And we have subcommittees that meet in between the time. So there's a lot of work that has to be done. The other thing about to where the money comes from, Jacksonville has to, at some point in time, determine whether or not it's going to be a progressive community. We have other communities that have these civil rights museums. Everything Jacksonville does not make money. All of the enterprise, the Times Union Center and the Prime Osborne and other groups don't make money. But they attract people to Jacksonville. They put Jacksonville on the map. As rich as Jacksonville's civil rights history is, Jacksonville needs to have something that chronicles that, a repository for that great civil rights history. So we proactively need to do some things in that regard. The start has been made by President Brochet in putting this task force together. If nothing else happens, at least she made the start. Now, city leaders have to understand that this is part of the history of Jacksonville. So don't come up with reasons why we can't do something. Come up with reasons why we can do something and be positive and proactive about our history.
Now, in the last 5 minutes or less than 5 minutes or so that we have, Council President, I wanted to ask, you had mentioned on Twitter a while back, and you and I had spoken about this, about the possibility of, even if the task force was not going to be an official task force of the city, that you could call noticed meetings. And of course, then the members that would show up to these noticed meetings would also be able to talk to each other and would not be bound by Sunshine Law because it wouldn't be an official task force. What are your thoughts about A, either doing that, or B, what the co-chairs of the task force have been asking for, which is the possibility of carrying legislation to make some type of permanent committee at City Hall?
I think all of the options are on the table. I think I need an update too. You know, it's been a while since I've been able to participate in the meetings, and I'd like to hear. And there's been a lot of thought that's gone into this question for quite some time by the task force members. And so we have a lot of options, Ryan, and I'm very willing to continue having notice meetings every couple weeks or how often the group would like in order for us to continue to come together and make sure that we're putting a lot of energy and focus on this topic. And if that's the most streamlined way so that the task force members can collaborate and cooperate and communicate outside of these meetings, then that might be a win-win approach.
So, Mr. Hurst, last time that we spoke, you said that not only is there work that's necessary and that a permanent task force would be busy enough every year coming up with different ideas and continuing to tell the story of Jacksonville civil rights history. But you said it would also send a positive message to the city's African-American population. Why?
Because you want to let a total community understand that they are included. You want to let young people in the school system know that they are included. You want to make sure that people understand what the history is, and that history works both for the black community and the white community. White folk need to understand the salient contributions that blacks have made, not only to this country, but to the not only to the city, but to the country, and led by some of the folk who came out of Jacksonville. So when I'm sitting in a classroom, I'm sitting in a meeting, I'm attending a seminar with my white friends and my black friends, and I can pick up a book or I can read a narrative which talks inclusively about what everyone has done and the contributions different groups have made, not only to this country, but certainly to the city of Jacksonville, then that's a positive thing in terms of our history. And it shows that Jacksonville is moving to a level of being considered a progressive city.
In the last couple of minutes that we have, Council President, have you been in contact about this issue? I mean, I know that there are some sunshine issues, so maybe not specifically about anything that would be coming up in a city council agenda. But do you know what your successor's plans are, or not plans, but what his thoughts are on the Civil Rights Task Force? Has this been something that has been discussed at all?
It has not. And ultimately, because that's something we may vote upon, it's something mm-hmm. that he and I would have to discuss in a notice meeting ourselves. So I've been able to understand his thinking and his desire for more information from, you know, your articles and reporting on this.
Do you think that you'd want to call a notice meeting to discuss this with your successor?
I think that's a good idea to do. And it kind of goes back to me needing to participate in the next couple of meetings to right. make sure I understand where the task force members are and really understand the desire and the plan and how to convey that.
But Ryan, the point I have to make, I mean, I know that it's in the purview right now of the city council and President Brochet and incoming President Bowman, but this is not just a city council issue.
Mm-hmm.
The inclusion of the history in a fair and relative way is a community issue, which is the way we have approached the task force, that we are members of the community talking about community history.
Well, thank you to you both for being here talking about this morning. I appreciate it. Much more still ahead. Later, we'll talk with Catherine Thomas, founder of Yoga for Change. She's speaking at the Women's Wednesday speaker series for She is Fierce in St. Augustine. But up next, the Five and Dime brings the story of Matthew Shepard to a local stage 20 years after the gay college student was brutally beaten to death. Back in a moment.
Helmsbacher Education presents its annual legal update on June 13th in Jacksonville and June 14th in St. Augustine. This seminar will cover new laws affecting condominium and homeowner associations. Register at Eventbrite. More information, 904-737-4600. Community Hospice and Palliative Care. Since 1979, the compassionate guide for more than 200,000 patients facing advanced illness in Northeast Florida. Today, serving 16 counties, including yours. Available 24/7 to help you and your loved one. More at choosecommunityhospice.com.
WJCT and Baptist Health are pleased to announce that Bobby Thomas, beauty and fashion expert and author of The Power of Style, Everything You Need to Know Before You Get Dressed, will be this year's keynote speaker at A Day for Her, Saturday, August 18th at the Hyatt Hotel. Bobby, the style editor for The Today Show, will share Bobby's buzz tips on everything from favorite beauty tricks to her favorite lifestyle finds. For more information or to purchase tickets, log on to wjct.org/events.
Hi, I'm Andrew Wickman, host of Blues Horizon. The best in classic and modern blues is now on twice a week. Blues Horizon, Monday and Wednesday nights at 11, right here on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back. Well, in October 1998, University of Wyoming student Matthew Shepard was brutally murdered, his body tied to a fence in the freezing cold of Laramie, Wyoming. The homophobia-motivated crime lit the country on fire and ignited a national debate on hate crimes legislation. The 2000 play Laramie, written by Moises Kaufman and the Tectonic Theater Project, tells the story of the aftermath. Lee Hamby and Brian Neese from the Five and Dime Theater are here to tell us more about this Friday's local premiere of that wrenching play. Welcome.
Good morning.
Morning.
So, Lee, I want to talk to you first. Sure. What made you decide to put on the show? Although I'm not sure the actual violence of Shepard's death is portrayed in the play, it's still very difficult subject matter.
Absolutely. We did this year a what we call the director season. So we had local directors pitch us shows that they wanted to do on our stage. And this was one of them that Lee Beeger, that is directing, pitched to us. And we have always loved that show. And she sold it to us. And we thought it was such an important story to tell, of course. And so that's how that came about.
So what went into deciding, because obviously, like you said, you had other requests out there or other ideas. I mean, what was the deciding factor into choosing Laramie?
If anybody knows us as a theater company, they know that we take on these kinds of stories. And so it was kind of the decision was easy for us because it was such a strong, important story to tell. Not all shows have that. You know, some people might say that they want to see us do more comedy. The problem with comedy, for the most part, is that there's no meat to it. Mm. So when we pick a show, we usually like to take you on an emotional roller coaster is what we like to do. So there's comedy in everything. This show even has some comedy in it. And you have to find that comedy when you have something so tragic to tell. So it was an easy choice for us to want to tell this story because it's very relevant still today, as we all know.
Right. Brian, tell me a little bit about your experience with this show. What character are you playing and what the process has been like to kind of get into the head of that character?
Well, I play multiple characters. And okay. one of the beauties of this show is it is truly an ensemble piece. There are no leads, no actors save the narrator get to just do one thing the entire show. And I think that's one of the strengths of the show is it provides multiple perspectives. Mm-hmm. You know, in a time, in a climate when we may feel extremism quite succinctly, and I don't know that anyone before us felt it differently. There's probably always been extremes, you know, sides of an issue.
Right.
This piece doesn't delve into those. It provides a mosaic of all of the rich nuances of perspective. And so as an actor, when you're playing 5, 6, 7 different characters, some who are diametrically opposed in their viewpoint and some who fit in any number of places on that spectrum, it's a real rich tapestry of perspectives and narrative and art.
how do you juggle all of those perspectives in one single show? Because, you know, most of the time people are used to playing one character on stage, maybe a couple for a single play. But as you said, five. I mean, that's a lot.
I think I actually play seven. Most of us play five to seven.
Wow.
And, you know, we just write everything on our inside palm. I'm just kidding. but you may have a character who only has three lines and someone else who has pages of dialogue, and having to bring the right amount of focus and insight and character development to each one of them has been a challenge. But again, we're all doing that. And so we are all in the best mode of the craft of theater. We are each making the other better, because when we bring our A game, we make the other one look better too in this ensemble piece.
Lee, did the fact that this is going to be put on during Pride Month factor into this decision at all?
It did, yeah. We thought it was important because we in Jacksonville don't really celebrate Pride and Pride Month, which is weird, like as far as, the big events. So we do that in October. So we wanted to do something for Pride during Pride. And this was definitely something that, even though it's not the happiest of stories, it's something that we need to tell as a piece of history. A lot of the kids today don't even know the story. Mm-hmm. I've talked to a few people of a certain age that had no idea this even happened. So I would really encourage high school kids and people of that age to come see this and listen to this, because this is so important to hear.
Now, full disclosure, I haven't seen the actual play. I've heard and read about it, of course, but the aftermath of Matthew Shepard's death also includes the rise to power of a group that many around the country would probably recognize, even if they don't know necessarily the story of Matt Shepard, and that is the Westboro Baptist Church, and what they're known for, of course, the Fred Phelps led church until his death, was known for protesting gay funerals and military funerals, and it really came to the nation's attention during Shepard's. It was kind of the first televised role for the Westboro Baptist Church. How does Laramie deal with that?
It's interesting that you've mentioned that, because it's such a big thing. And I know the director that's directing this, Lee Beeger, directed the show before at Douglas Anderson School of the Arts. Mm. And back then, I think it was like 2000, 2001, she did that. And they were saying they were coming to protest. So for a high school to get that word that they're coming to protest is a huge deal. I've always thought about what if it happened to us. We haven't gotten any word that that's happening. I don't know if we would, but I don't think that they do it as much as they used to.
Is Fred Phelps a character in Larry?
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
So somebody has to play
a serious character. Yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah. The beauty of this piece, if you're not familiar with it, the company Moises Kaufman and his Tectonic Theater Project actually did 2 years' worth of interviews with all of the people involved in this story. And
there's 60 people in the story, by the way.
Wow.
Use those transcripts to write the words of this play. And so it's what real people said, the majority of the show. And Fred Phelps is in there, the majority of what he said, and is on tape as having said. And the beauty of, I was thinking about this last night during the Tony Awards, which theater people watch, and John Leguizamo said that theater teaches how to empathize with people not like us. Mm-hmm. And this play does that very well, even with the Fred Phelps character.
Yeah.
Well, thank you to both of you for joining us on First Coast Connect. A difficult play, I'm sure, but one that people wouldn't want to miss. It starts Friday, right?
Starts Friday, mm-hmm. Runs through July 1st, so it's 3 weekends.
Okay.
www.thefiveanddime.org.
Well, thank you to both. We'll be right back.
I'm Doug Hansard, and I listen to the Florida Times Union On Demand as read by WJCT Radio Reading Service volunteers. The sound quality is excellent. This is a great asset for people like me, sightless and on the go. The Florida Times Union Daily on the radio reading website at wjct.org/radio reading. Take advantage of it, and while you're there, register as a listener.
Welcome back. Well, Catherine Thomas is the founder of Yoga for Change, and she's speaking at the Women's Wednesday Speaker Series this Wednesday, June 13th, at the Treasury in St. Augustine for the group She is Fierce. Catherine, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
So tell us a little bit about Yoga for Change to start off. I guess it would be safe to say that most people are pretty familiar with what yoga is, but what's the change part of it?
Awesome. Yeah. So Yoga for Change was started in 2014. And what we do is we bring a trauma-informed, evidence-based approach to individuals who have suffered trauma, specifically like veterans dealing with PTSD or military sexual trauma, incarcerated vets all over Duval County, youth and substance abuse. So we bring a program to the facilities that are treating their clients as a way to help with their recovery, rehabilitation, as opposed to asking them to come to a facility. Right. So we don't actually have a brick and mortar. We go to where they are, which is great.
And do you think that makes you feel, makes the clients feel, well, not only are you more accessible, but do they feel more comfortable? It's like you're coming into their space instead of, because if they're going through this kind of trauma and stuff, and I'm not sure if it would be all that comfortable to go to a separate brick and mortar place.
Yeah, I mean, what we do is we add into whatever rehabilitation program that they are currently involved in, and we don't ask them to show up in any other way than what they are in. So whatever clothes they're currently wearing, whatever physical limitations they're currently dealing with, we meet them where they are so that they leave feeling more empowered and thus able to kind of deal with whatever sort of trauma is going on and be able to give back to the community upon their release.
So She is Fierce is a group whose main principle is women's empowerment. What can we expect from your talk, and how does Yoga for Change fit within that system?
Well, we as an organization want to remind everyone that they are fierce, no matter what has ever happened to them or what maybe they have done. So they are fierce. They can achieve whatever outcome they want to achieve. They might need to be able and get some support, either with dealing with their trauma or maybe a networking event. And so this sort of event is for women who are wanting to feel empowered and feel connected and feel like they can achieve, that they're fierce and that they can go out into whatever situation, whatever job application, whatever business opportunity, and just know that they are good enough to achieve whatever outcome they put ahead of themselves. Just like our students, that they're good enough to stay clean. They're good enough to stay out of trouble. They're good enough to get back. They're good enough to deal with whatever PTSD stuff that they're having on in their life, and that they can give back because they're good enough.
So just remind our listeners when the talk is and where and what they need to do to be part of it.
So it's Wednesday night. There's a cocktail hour at 5. It's in St. Augustine, and it's an amazing location in St. Augustine. And it's put on by She is Fierce, which with Kelly Youngs, who is a powerhouse. And so we hope you can join us. Check out on Facebook both She is Fierce and Yoga for Change is posting about it right now.
Thank you so much for being here, Catherine.
Thank you so much, Ryan.
We'll be right back with Culpepper and the World of Sports.
Ansbacher Education presents its annual legal update on June 13th in Jacksonville and June 14th in St. Augustine. This seminar will cover new laws affecting condominium and homeowner associations. Register at Eventbrite. More information, ansbachereducation.com.
Community Hospice and Palliative Care. Since 1979, the compassionate guide for more than 200,000 patients facing advanced illness in Northeast Florida. Today, serving 16 counties, including yours. Available 24/7 to help you and your loved one. More at choosecommunityhospice.com.
The EPA is in the news a lot, but it's rarely about the environment.
Raises given to two of his political aides.
A condo he rented from the wife of.
Now there's a new question involving a used mattress.
The agency's administrator is championed by conservatives who say the left is out to thwart his reforms. What's going on with Scott Pruitt? Next time on 1A. weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Oftentimes, it's local governments that provide shelter for the homeless. Now, though, the healthcare industry is seeing the economic upside.
You've got a major corporation saying it's within our business interests to recognize this relationship and increase the stock of affordable housing.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the business opportunity in health and housing. Next time on Marketplace, weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
From the work of C.B. Moore in the late 1800s to the discovery of the Miami Circle 20 years ago, Florida archaeology has had some controversy. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with archaeologist Jerry Milanich. We'll discuss a secret NASA postage stamp and talk about Jones High School in Orlando. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, the Florida Gators are one win away from a return to the College World Series, and there is so much.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
And of course, that is the theme music for our own sports analyst, Cole Pepper, who's in the studio as he is every Monday.
Morning, Ryan. You talked about the Gators. You remember they're the national champions from last year. They're trying to repeat as national champions in baseball. Last night, they had the opportunity to win their Super Regional over Auburn, but lost in the ninth inning. So it goes to a decisive third game, winner-take-all in the Super Regional tonight at 8 p.m. in Gainesville. Yesterday, a 3-2 loss for the Gators. Trying to get back, it is not as unusual to see a team repeat as College World Series champions as it is to see them repeat as either NCAA champions in baseball, in basketball or football. But it doesn't happen all that often. We've seen it a few times through the years, and it would be a big accomplishment for the Gators.
What makes it more common?
Well, I'm mostly pitching. When you have a team that has great pitching, that tends to really carry it. And that's the case with the Gators again this year. They had a couple of pitchers taken in the first round of the Major League Baseball draft. Guys taken very early. They have a very good closer, Eric Byrne, who had a rare blown save last night. So their pitching is very good. This year, though, they're also hitting much better than they did a year ago. A lot more power in the lineup. This is a very good Gators team that's been number one or number two in the nation most of the season. And it would be a bit of an upset if they did not make it to Omaha tonight against Auburn. So the Jaguars, meanwhile, getting ready to get back on the field. 3 days of minicamp. Tomorrow, Wednesday, and Thursday, the mandatory minicamp, unlike the 10 OTAs, the organized team activity sessions, these are not voluntary to attend, so we do expect to see Jalen Ramsey and also Leonard Fournette out on the field tomorrow. Ramsey did not work on the field with the team in any of the days during the OTAs. So here's what I've seen from the Jaguars so far this offseason. Ryan, as I go through an offseason, usually there is a theme that I get questions from folks in the public or in social media who want to ask me about a specific thing. Last year, largely, it was, how does Blake Bortles look? This year, it has not been quite as pointed. And when you have success, you might kind of expect that it would turn a little right. bit. This year, basically, it's, what do you think? How do they look? Are we going to be good again? It's sort of that sort of theme. So I will say this. It's very early to start making judgment calls on a team when they're practicing in, you know, T-shirts and shorts and not in shoulder pads and not hitting and not, you know, it's pajama practice, as Doug Marrone calls it. But they do look like a team that is confident. They know they've had success last year. They know how to have success. They look like a team that expects to be a team contending for a championship this year. On Bortles, he has looked better. The ball looks better coming out of his hand. Remember, he had some shoulder surgery in the offseason to have things cleaned up there. That seems to have been a benefit. But again, I want to see him when he's under fire, when there are pass rushers coming after him, and when the game is on the line. That's ultimately where we're going to judge Blake Bortles. How does he do in the fourth quarter of close games? Because that's the next step for him to take in his evolution as a quarterback. I think the most intriguing position group right now is wide receivers. There's no true number one wide receiver, but there are a number of guys who on a given day could be that guy. Dante Moncrief, the free agent signee, DJ Chark, the second-round draft pick, are certainly intriguing. The Jaguars also have returning from last year, Keelan Cole and D.D. Westbrook. Marquise Lee is the lone veteran returner in the Jaguars' wide receiving room. And Rashad Green is another one to keep an eye on. Injured last year, A couple of years ago, he looked like a guy who might be able to help him, took a little bit of a step back in 2016, injured in 2017. We'll see if the former Florida State Seminole can make a spot on the roster for himself this year. Too early to say if the defense is going to be as good as it was last year, but there's been nothing to say otherwise so far. They were so good last year and made a couple of additions this year to that defensive side. After 3 days of minicamp, the Jaguars will be back on the field next at the end of July when they begin training camp.
All right, what else do we have here on the docket?
Well, after 37 years without a Triple Crown winner, we now have 2 in 4 years. Justify led Wire to Wire winning the Belmont Stakes on Saturday, joining American Pharoah as the most recent Triple Crown winners. Clearly Justify, a tremendous horse, undefeated and a Triple Crown winner. It's interesting to me that with all the money in the breeding of horses and horse racing these days, that it's possible to even have a Triple Crown winner. You'd think there'd be more parity. There's far more science in thoroughbred racing now than there ever has been, analytics and genetics and training and nutrition, and yet we've seen two horses do what no horse had done since Affirmed in 1978, and both trained by the same guy, Bob Baffert, who I think has to be considered as the greatest trainer in modern horse racing history. Want to touch on the Armada, who lost their first game in the league on Saturday, falling on the road to Palm Beach 4-2. The Armada still leads the division. They'll play Thursday at Miami United and back home on Sunday at UNF's Hodges Stadium. Sharks lost a 40-point game on Saturday. They're in fourth place in the six-team NASL. They're home Saturday to face the Maine Mammoths, and the Jumbo Shrimp continue a 10-game homestand tonight at 7:05 against the Biloxi Shuckers. So it's the Shuckers and the Shrimp, which sounds like a tasty thing
that,
to hit.
It's going to get more and more difficult, I'm sure, to call that game as the night goes on. Well, that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Kerm runs the board. The show's theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Download the WJCT app to listen anytime. Next is 1A with Joshua Johnson. I'm Ryan Bank, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM. Your community, your world.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.